athletes, take your mark, get set. It's time for the Attitude Athlete Podcast. Everybody out there, Coach Blue Robinson here. I want to give each of you a special thanks and a little sense of gratitude for downloading, sharing, and subscribing to this podcast. If you could jump on and leave us a review on whatever platform you are loving and enjoying this podcast on, please do so. It helps us increase our reach, and it helps us get this podcast into the ears of those who may need a little bit more information about addiction and addiction recovery. I want to turn our attentions to the website. We've got lots of great content on there. A lot of free stuff, free resources for you to download, listen to, share, and maybe learn about addiction and addiction recovery on this new pathway of sobriety. I also want to give everyone out there a special thanks who is participating in our Patreon program. We couldn't thank you enough. It's you guys who are the backbone of helping Team Addict to Athlete's message get spread further. And I like Patreon because it feels like we're giving you something back in return. Bonus episodes, exclusive content, promotions, deals, all kinds of stuff. So if you'd like to become a Patreon subscriber, you can do so by jumping on patreon.com/addicttoathlete. You can pick through all the tiers that we have set up and designed that will help move Addict to Athlete's message forward, but also give you something in return. But I want to give a special shout out and thanks to our Patreon subscribers right now. They include our super fans. We've got Coach Tara Butson. Thank you so much, Coach. Brett Frew, Coach Chris Williams, and the Warrior Within podcast and personal development by Sensei KP. Scott Foster and the Foster family, Paulie Davies, and of course, Jerem Thurston. Thank you, all of our super fans. We appreciate you being willing to support Team Addict to Athlete. Our rookie level subscribers, we've got Joe Jackson, Earl Dyer, Kenny Roseman, and Josh Hansen. Thank you so much, Josh, and all you rookie level subscribers. Our pro levels, we've got Selena Armitage and Gary Thurston. Thank you both so, so much. And of course, our championship level subscribers. They include Shad and Freya Robison and the Robison family, Ron and D. Loesch, and Tracy Whitby. Thank you all so much, our championship level subscribers. Athletes, I want to welcome today's guests. Today, we'll be speaking with Pat Miletich. For those who don't know, Pat is a former mixed martial artist fighting in the UFC and is raised to be a champion in that industry. Pat's also been a commentator on ESPN Sports, specifically for the UFC, and has his own podcast and has really kind of got a mindset of how to overcome fear, how to overcome some of the pain, and how to get your mind focused on what challenges lie ahead. Pat, I want to thank you for joining Team Addict to Athletes podcast today, brother. I want to thank you for spending some time with us. Let's just jump into it, brother. Tell us a little bit about you.
Good. Thank you. I apologize. I got to do this on my phone in my car. I don't even have Wi-Fi at my house.
Dude, you're lucky then. That means you don't have to do too much of the crazy online work ethic crap that's going on these days, huh?
I work literally from my phone constantly.
Dude, that yeah,
if I need to, you know what I mean? So that way I've prepared my house with solar panels, chicken coop.
Nice.
It's got a well, it's got city water, but I'm way out. I'm like the furthest out you can be to even get city water. And, so I've got,
nice.
I don't eat meat very often, but even though in the freezer, just because I unfortunately I'm burdened with being able to see into the future.
Yeah.
I've got, 2 cows, 2 deer and an entire hog in freezers.
Dude. That is awesome. There's nothing wrong with being prepared, man. I'm telling you, like, if anything's proven that this last year or so, that's the way to go, buddy.
Well, and I ask when people think I'm crazy, I go, how many billionaires and multimillionaires do you think are not prepping?
Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. I have some good friends up north from here, Salt Lake City, that they run the PrepperCon, and going in there and seeing how underprepared we are, I'm like, oh man, all right, we gotta do a few things here, because you're gonna want more than just toilet paper next time or this happens, you know.
Well, the toilet paper thing is just a test to see how people will react.
It makes perfect sense, man. It really does. Yeah. And we were doing an aid station for an ultra marathon right as this whole thing kind of broke, and we were down in Page, Arizona. And it was like tumbleweeds, man. It was so sketchy. Walked into their grocery stores, their Walmarts, everything gone. And I was like, ooh, we better get home. Like, this is not good. So I don't blame you, man. I think it's good. And being off the grid that way, there's a certain sense of relaxation that comes with that, buddy.
Yeah. Well, and people just aren't paying attention anymore. And the fear-based conditioning is working so well on people that, you know, they don't even, nobody sees the things that are happening and what is coming. And, you know, the hyperinflation that's going to hit it's going to cause grocery store. People are going to be broke. They're going to be starving, and they're going to be, basically pillaging, looting grocery stores.
Yeah.
Because they'll be starving. And that's the thing, you know, when you see, Black Friday fights at places over TVs, you got to remember that's on full stomachs.
Yeah. True, man. Yeah, that's a whole other window. I didn't even think about that, but you're right. That stuff that they have that expendable cash that means something in their pockets, and that's not how it's going to be next go around. I mean, I hear you, buddy. That's wild. Well, Pat, thanks for jumping on and doing this, man. Ed was talking a lot about you and was telling us a little bit about. And I've heard about you through David Clark. He had the utmost respect for you. And I don't know if you know much about Addict to Athlete, but David helped us a lot with Addict to Athlete. It's a group that we started to help people, instead of going to 12-step based recovery, use health, wellness, movement, action oriented service to get clean and to no longer be anonymous. And so Dave, this immunated all that stuff, man. And so he had a high regard of respect for you. And then when Ed said, "Hey, I know him," we're like, I'd love to get him on the podcast. So thank you for carving out some time, brother. Appreciate this.
No, thank you. And David made a huge impact on my life. You know, I gotta tell you, you know, cause I had two older brothers who had committed suicide, you know, back when I was, you know, in my 20s. I cried as much when David died as when my brothers did. We were really good buddies, but you know, I just picture him the way he was, you know, if his spirit could be seen by us, he'd be patting you on the back going, "Hey man, it's just life." It's not bad. It's not good. It's just life.
It just is. That's the thing, is he'd be laughing at us for still kind of being in that morning set of frame of mind. Cause he's like, "Hey, get off it, move on." Like I hear that same thing, brother. So, but this is the thing, is I remember when he was training in MMA and he was talking about this, some of the things he was experiencing and overcoming some of that fear. He brought you up quite often about just your mindset about, you know, things that you've gone through, because like you said, you've lost family members, you've struggled with addictions. This podcast is designed to help people who are just kind of coming out of that darkness, realizing that there's something on the other side. And so as we get into this, I'd love to know more about your story and then talk a little bit about some of the things that I find real interesting about you, specifically your Leadville experience, because you started that and you got injured and got pulled. And I could just see the little video clip that I watched of you of like wanting to go on, but like having been pulled out, you know, and I get this with my athletes all the time. It's better to have a DNF than a DNS. It's about showing up and giving it all you've got, even if it's not going to carry you all the way through. I think in that interview, you said something to the tune of, "Hey, I've lost fights before, but I've come back." And I love the fact that you didn't have a DNS. You didn't like sleep in that day or thought, "Well, I can't do this," or "I'm not really prepared." Like, I think we give up on ourselves way too much. So I'd love to get into some of those aspects if that's cool with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, you know, Leadville, I didn't understand what I was getting into. Mm-hmm. I literally did not understand at all what I was getting into until, you know, I had some good coaching from David and from some of the guys here, John O'Brien and John Byrne and guys that were amazing runners. But you know, I didn't even understand at the beginning of it because there was something wrong with me and I couldn't figure out what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in a lot of pain and a lot of confusion. And, you know, I was drinking to deal with anxiety. And I tell you, I went, I got blood tests. Mm-hmm. And my friend, and I made fun of people who are gluten intolerant, right? I go, what is this, right? And then when I got blood tests done by my friend who's been giving speeches on the endocrine system since he was 16 years old, looked at me after I got my blood after he got my blood test back, and he goes, "You have to stop eating wheat and soy. You're going to be dead you're going to be dead from a heart attack in 3 years if you don't. There's so much inflammation in your body because of it." He goes, "You have three types of arthritis." He goes, "You got psoriatic arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, and one other one that I didn't even remember." And my gut bacteria was destroyed.
Yeah. And so
it was giving off bad chemicals that were causing my brain to not work right, you know.
Yeah,
and
man.
And that was giving me a lot of problems. So after that, I was able to start running further and further and further. One training run that we did was 50 miles down a blacktop, two-lane highway in Iowa,
man,
in early July. But it was 95 degrees the whole day, sunny, and about 95% humidity. And the corn was big, and so corn sweats. It gives off humidity itself. So I heat stroked for about 4 or 5 hours of that run. I mean, one of my friends, John Byrne, who's finished Leadville, I think three times, looked at me and he goes, "How you doing, little buddy?" Cause he's like 6'4".
Yeah.
And all I could muster was, "I'm not going to die. I'm not going to die."
Yeah.
And during that run, he kind of planned out the run, but he thought that the next town was only 5 miles away where we could refill our bottles and get something to snack on at a gas station. And it ended up being 10 miles. So we drank the water for 5 miles. So we guzzled our water.
Yeah, man.
And our hydration. And by the time we got into this little town of Adelissa, we had been out of water for a long time, and the gas station no longer existed.
Oh, no way.
And so John O'Brien,
sucker punch.
John O'Brien is a Southie from Boston. He works at John Deere here. Nice. And he's funnier than hell. He cusses a lot. And he goes, "This is the dumbest thing I have ever done in my life." He goes, "This is how people die."
Yeah.
And he's an excellent runner. And so, you know.
So you're thinking, oh, great.
My pee looked like coffee for 3 days.
Nice, man. Oh, my gosh.
Pretty interesting run, to say the least.
It blows my mind, but that's what I'm talking about. You're in that situation. You're like, this is how people die, but you had already experienced all kinds of pain, all kinds of, physical, emotional, mental, spiritual, even. And yet you kept going. I can only imagine as they were kind of maybe internally kind of crumbling, being like, "Well, what did we get you guys into?" You're like, "Well, we got to get out of it." So I love that mentality. Brother, tell me a little bit about your history. I read your Wikipedia page, and you didn't come from rainbows and sunshine. I mean, you really did kind of have, like, similar to me, this troubled kind of like fight for what you want. I keep the people that you love close, but it was a challenge for you, wasn't it? This is that DNS versus DNF. Like, you had every reason to throw in the towel and just kind of become, the average run of the mill, say drug addict, criminal, what have you, but you didn't, despite all of the chaos and I guess the battle that you were facing. Why didn't you throw in the towel? Why did you fight for something bigger and I guess more important to you rather than just settling, I guess? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, when I was a little kid, my dad was an alcoholic and very abusive. Mm-hmm. And the one thing through my soul searching is that I found that he did me one favor. Mm-hmm. He was an amazing coach. So I did learn a lot from him from that. I mean, in the public's eye, here's a guy that started the Dad's Club. He started a football league, right. Which still exists today. Mm-hmm. And was an amazing football coach. But I think when I was very little, I remember that we were going to church all the time, and then all of a sudden we just stopped. And later on, I learned that was because my two oldest brothers were molested by priests.
Oh, man.
And so, back then, my mom and dad, there was nobody to turn to.
Right.
There was no, who's going to believe you mm-hmm. at that time? And so I think that's when the drinking started for him and the bitterness and everything else. And
right.
His world imploded. So he started to become abusive. But the one thing I was being taught how to shoot a pellet gun across the street at the neighbor's house in their backyard. The dad was teaching his son and I, mm-hmm. and the dad was leaning against the back of their house. So my dad couldn't see their dad monitoring us. Mm-hmm. All he saw was me standing back past the house, shooting across the yard with a pellet gun.
Right.
So he screamed at me and told me, you know, to get home. And he goes, go in the bedroom, pull your pants down and grab your ankles. And he pulled his belt off.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at that moment I decided, because, you know, I tried to plead with him and explain what was going on, but he was probably drunk and not listening. Right. So that was the worst beating he ever gave me. Mm. But I told myself, not going to cry, not going to make a sound, nothing.
Wow.
And so when he got done, I pulled up my pants and I just stood there and looked at him,
mm-hmm.
just with complete indignation. And so it wasn't long after that he left. He left when I was 7 or 8. So it wasn't long, you know, after that.
Right. But,
so what gift he gave me in all of that was my ability to not feel pain or to get through pain,
mm-hmm.
I fought a fight in Japan with a broken leg. I fought Jose Pele Landy, the number 2 fighter in the world at the time, an amazing athlete, with a really bad back injury and pelvis stuff going on, right. where I literally couldn't walk. Couldn't walk, literally. And a doctor gave me 12 shots of Xylocaine in my lower back and my pelvic region just so I could walk out to the cage to start to fight because I needed the money.
Right. Yeah. Right?
So, but you know, it was, you know, that was something that it was just a gift from him. But I think as life went on, I was in a junior college and I was wrestling and my mom got sick with heart problems. So I had to go home and take care of her because all my older brothers at the time, they were still alive.
Right.
My 3 older brothers and sister were all married and had families. And so they really couldn't dedicate all their time to helping her. So I went home, started working 3 jobs. I was taking care of her.
Right.
And so that was an interesting time because even though I was working 3 jobs, I really wasn't making that much money. I was pouring concrete and then bouncing and bartending and stuff like that. And so I would go behind a friend of mine taught me how to go behind grocery stores in the dumpsters and get the expired food. The bread, even the eggs, orange juice, all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd freeze what you could and then hurry up and eat what you couldn't freeze.
You couldn't. Like the eggs and
stuff. Yeah. So I did that. That
makes perfect sense.
I did that for about 3 years.
That makes perfect sense. It's that will to get the job done. I mean, I know what that's like, having no food in the house, having mom who knows where, and sneaking in the neighbor's house, you know, to see what you can take out of their place that they won't notice right away. So I get that a lot. My question for you then is that pain, because as I'm watching your videos, as I'm kind of, you know, learning up about you, I get thinking, man, there is a special breed of individual, of athlete that would dare step in a boxing ring, let alone a mixed martial art ring, because, man, the mixed martial art is so, I don't know, the disciplines are relatively same, but mixed martial arts, man, that is all about like just being like on the aware, right? And the pain. And I'm thinking, man, you know, I've had stepdads with the same kind of, you know, physical abuse, all that stuff. And, you know, it's interesting to me, brother, that you would say, I'm taking this and pain's only going to be temporary. But for me, man, it was so scary. And I hated it so bad that I avoided it so much, which led to substance use for me for many years, covering pain. You battled some addictions, but you didn't cover your pain totally with that. How did you avoid that feeling of pain? Because like you said, dad taught you something that day that, you know what, I'm not doing anything wrong, but I'm getting punished for it. So I'm just going to roll with this. How in the world did you, because on your Leadville, I'm watching you climb that last mountain before your buddy's like, man, you with me? And you're like, yeah, I had a tumble back there, messed up my calf. And you kept going. Like if it wasn't for that lady saying, dude, you got to hit medical, you'd have kept going, man. How in the world can you,
How do you shift the pain, brother? I'm so curious. Like, that's such an interesting mindset to me.
Well, it's just, I think injuries to me are for the most part just annoying, right? Besides, I had a real severe neck injury where my left side of my body atrophied and I couldn't use my left arm. I had to rehab myself. I went to a neurosurgeon and he showed me that my spinal cord had been crushed by a disc that had exploded. A guy hit me with a bomb left hook in sparring. And basically in the first round, we were kind of warming up and out of nowhere, he cranked up a bomb hook on my neck or on my jaw, and it spun my head and I felt my neck crunch. And then my left hand dropped and it wouldn't work. And it was right at the end of the first round. And so I looked at him and I, right at the start of the second round, I said, let's pick it up this round. Because I wanted him to understand that I was going to pick it up. Right. And so I blasted him with three right hands in a row because I couldn't use my left. It was hanging down by my side. And I crushed his nose and he had to have surgery. Mm. That was it for sparring for that day for him.
Yeah, time to go.
But I went to a neurosurgeon and he goes, you have to have surgery. You're literally like you're millimeters away from being Christopher Reeves.
Yeah.
And I didn't like the diagnosis. So I went to another person, got another opinion. And then I went to a third and all of them said, you have to have surgery. And so I just said to myself, no, I'm going to rehab it myself. So I rehabbed and I got my left side to come back. I went to Dr. Juring, who's at the sports rehab facility at Palmer Chiropractic. Mm-hmm. And they would lay me on my sides and put me in weird positions and have me resist certain ways. It's hard to explain how they do it.
Right.
But they were trying to get new neural pathways to open mm-hmm. up. And so I was able to start using my left arm again. I rebuilt myself and I was never the same after that, but now, you know, because they wanted to fuse my vertebrae together in my spine. Mm-hmm. Well, it did that on its own naturally. So I saved a bunch of money and the power that made the body healed the body.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. God, that's
my right arm. Interesting. It happened again to my right side. And I didn't fully get all of my bicep and front of my delt, my shoulder, to come all the way back. But, you know, I was able to rehab it because I'd been through it before.
Jeez, man. Like that blows my mind. Again, the patience that I think it would require to like say, well, I'm going to do this first. Because again, we in America, we don't like pain. I mean, walk down your grocery store pharmaceutical aisle, maximum strength Tylenol, extra strength Bear. We want pain gone now. Why do you think people have such a hard time kind of flowing with pain? Recognize that it's because there's a problem, but then being okay with like, all right, I'm going to do what I can with this, but it's not going to buckle me. It's not going to make me take a knee, so to speak. Why do you think we are so afraid of pain?
You know, I think mankind in general has gone against nature in everything that we've done. You know, nature, it's like, you know, one of my friends was talking about it. He's a producer. He's done some shows on A&E mm-hmm. and he's a very insightful guy. And he said, this was the best analogy that I had heard.
Right.
And he goes, think about it. He goes, you know, there are slow deer and old deer that, you know, the wolves catch,
yeah.
You know, so what do you, it would be like what humans are doing is basically saying, no, we're going to just slow down the coyotes. Right.
Yeah.
So they can't catch the slow deer, whatever. But that's almost how counterintuitive humans are because of our compassion, probably because we don't want people to die. Of course, right. We want to take care of people, but that's mostly for the general citizen. It's easy to convince the average citizen who isn't really aware that, you know, that health comes in, you know, pharmaceutical drugs and a mask instead of an immune system because you've been eating correctly and taking the right supplements and not man-made supplements, but 100% organic plant-based mm-hmm. type supplements like black oxygen, which I discovered and it changed my life. Mm. So, you know, that's the thing is I haven't worn a mask during this whole thing. I refuse to. And I have been, you know, kicked out of a few places,
right.
where it's the business's choice, but I just refuse to wear a mask. It's I'm not programmable by the media. It's everything yeah. about me. I don't know what it was or why it is 100%. I'm starting to learn why, mm-hmm. why some people are different than others.
Mm-hmm.
Why we look at things and we're not programmable.
Mm.
You know, and so for me, when I see something on the news, I instantly can laugh. I can laugh at what they're saying and right. understand the fear-based conditioning that they're trying to instill in the people. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just don't fall for it. So that's why I haven't worn a mask. And
that's interesting. That's interesting because that does sum up some of that pain question I have then. And you bring up another, because these two things seem to go hand in hand, and that's fear and pain, right? Fear of pain has kept us from doing a lot of things that we probably could have done and learned a lot from. The pandemic, for instance, you know, when it first started kind of coming into light, it was a ton of fear. I mean, I remember sitting with my family and hearing all the media and being like, maybe this is a thing. And that panic, that fear, how do you channel that? Because again, people in recovery, they're afraid of getting clean because it's going to hurt. People in life, they're afraid to step in the ring, so to speak, because it's going to hurt. So pain, I get your understanding of that. How do you not allow fear to drive you to pull back, to, you know, jump in deeper? I mean, how do you avoid that fear concept?
Well, I mean, look, at a time I was drinking because I had anxiety and fear.
Okay. Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how I was coping with it. You know, the alcohol is just a symptom.
Right. Right?
Alcohol is just a symptom, but I was having trouble absorbing and comprehending why I could see into the future so well and nobody else could.
Right.
Or very few could. My co-host on my podcast, The Conspiracy Farm, and we deliberately called it that
mm-hmm.
because we were trying to dispel the myth of the word conspiracy or conspiracy theorist, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was started by the CIA after the JFK assassination.
Right.
So, mm-hmm. so the people that were questioning things would look like lunatics.
Exactly.
And so the fears that I would have from the pandemic is not from a virus because I'm looking at statistics. I'm objectively looking at things and looking at the numbers, and this thing, you know, even by the CDC standards, and this is not political. This is science.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've had immunologists and molecular scientists on our show to discuss this stuff honestly and openly.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, the vulnerable, the elderly were absolutely dying from it. Right. Mm-hmm. I got it way back in last January before they even told us it was here.
Oh man.
And it affected me severely because I have a damaged respiratory system. And this is before I got on black oxygen.
Okay? Interesting. Yeah.
So I would get pneumonia every winter and it would literally wipe me out. There was a couple winters where I got pneumonia so bad where I said, yeah, I might not make it through this one. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, but I wasn't afraid of a virus. I was afraid of the people that were convinced that we had to lock everything down and wear masks.
Mm-hmm.
That's what scared me because I was reading the data. And the reason I knew it was coming was because we had spoken to economists and scientists and certain journalists who lost their jobs for telling the truth and explaining, you know, bioweapons labs and asymmetrical warfare and financial, what's happening in the financial world. And so about a year out from the lockdown, we started telling people that it was coming. And I said it would be the spring of 2020. So I knew it was coming.
Right.
I knew that asymmetrical warfare was coming and financial collapse was coming.
Yeah.
But the thing is, the one thing I didn't see was that what I felt, we had so many treasonous people in Washington, D.C. on both sides of the aisle.
Mm-hmm.
Who just went along with it. And, you know, I just want people to understand this one thing, whether you believe in it or not, as far as the virus goes,
mm-hmm.
is that the government and the agencies and the people that are the very wealthy in this world, the Bill Gateses of the world, mm-hmm. they wouldn't have thrown millions of people into abject poverty if they cared about you, And Bill yeah. Gates wouldn't be funding the World Health Organization, and pushing, you know, an experimental gene therapy shot. He'd be feeding the millions of starving children around the world.
Right.
He's got enough money. He's got enough money that he could feed everybody.
Yeah.
So yeah. that's what I'm trying to get through to people, that these people actually do not care for us. They don't, to the point, I think they have disdain for the common man. And that is my true belief. And I see it by their actions.
I've seen that too. I've seen that. It's interesting getting your perspective on that side of the coin, because I see it in that world of addiction recovery. I still see that we're losing upwards of 200 plus people a day from opiates and all this stuff. That's like a 747 crashing every day, right? And when a 747 falls down to the sky, they have all these professionals come out. They pick up every nut, every bolt, every shred of aluminum. They put it into a big, you know, facility. They reconstruct the plane. They find exactly what happened. Yeah. That many people every day just on opiates alone. And I'm thinking, where are the people that are supposed to be caring? Where are the people that are like supposed to be, you know, like concerned? But they're not. Their attentions are other places. And it's like we get a little bit of light on a story, and we get some, you know, some legislation passed through and all this stuff, but it's not enough. And I think you're right. I've seen that the bureaucracies on so many levels that it's like what you were talking about before we started recording about becoming self-sufficient. I think you have to do that in life, in recovery, in family. I'm curious, you saw the writing on the wall. You see the way society goes. We talked about the fear and the pain and whatnot. What's the ultimate? I mean, what do you feel like to become that self-made man, to be able to provide for the people that you love? You know, to say, hey, I know that this stuff is coming, whether it be the financial stuff, you know, the stuff with addictions, whatever, how to become that self-made man of like, I'm going to stand on my own 2 feet and then, you know, just watch, just wait. Is patience kind of your virtue for that? Or are you like kind of, you know, adding to maybe someone else's concern, like, oh crap, you know, Pat's over there doing this. Maybe I got to do this. And I'm curious how you get that message out to everybody. Like, don't panic, but be prepared.
Well, you know, I tell you, we had Billy Carson on our podcast, and he's an MIT educated propulsion scientist, but he's also much more than that. And if you go back and you listen to that episode, that it was our second time having him on, to where he said so many profound things that it melted me. It blew my mind. That he was as calm as he was. He understands, you know, and the thing that, you know, that I'm learning is it's not the thing that is the problem. It is how we react to the thing.
Agreed.
So what I was having trouble with was, again, understanding, trying to cope with why I could see into the future and other people could not.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, that I realized the numbers of people that we are going to have to deal with. You know, it's hard for me to say this. It is.
Yeah.
You know, I've done my research. I've spoken to people, like I said, that are scientists, and you know, people can look up the studies for themselves.
Right.
The gene therapy, this experimental gene therapy, when they did animal tests. You know, for instance, one that was done on ferrets, you know, when they introduced a new virus, all the ferrets died.
Mm.
Okay. That's what I'm afraid of. And I feel very strongly of the people that are getting this experimental gene therapy might not be around after this next flu season. And it bothers me a lot. It bothers me for mankind. Mm-hmm. And, because the people that are doing this, I think that they're doing some benevolent thing for the world.
Right.
I think that they're convinced that they are benevolent beings and they're good at, and they're good at convincing, other people, below them to buy this whole scenario.
Right. So Pat, my question for you then, brother, is because, you know, you're not typecasting yourself into one paradigm of lifestyle. What I mean by that is, you know, you are an incredible athlete. You are an amazing motivational guy. When you start forecasting this fight and you start talking about this arena, do people kind of like scratch their head and they're like, well, yeah, but we wanted to talk to the fighter. I don't want to talk to the prepper guy. But you're like, but this is the new fight, right? This is the new kind of like battleground. Do you have a hard time, I'm not convincing people, but having people like really lend you their ear for this kind of stuff? Because again, I think this stuff is super interesting. I think it goes into who you are as an athlete, as a human. And I think sometimes people might see this as kind of like, dude, is Pat off his rocker? But it's like the writing's on the wall, is it not?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I've been able to predict things pretty accurately for many years.
Well, I don't think you'd be a great fighter if you couldn't. That's the cool thing about this is you're not saying anything that I would say would be out of context, because it's like you have to anticipate and kind of predict what's coming next, or else you're going to get knocked out every fight, right?
Well, and I think the way my mind works is like an FBI detective who is investigating a serial killing,
mm-hmm.
right? He has to think like the serial killer.
Right.
Because my mind was programmed doing game plans against other fighters and game plans for my fighters against, you know, their opponents. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, you know, I ask fighters questions like this, where somebody would say, what is your game plan for the fight to beat this guy? I flip that around and I go, you have to look in the mirror and analyze yourself honestly and tell yourself what your opponent's game plan is to beat you.
Yeah.
To be able to read their minds and plan ahead. And that being combined with that, I'm a history buff and always have been.
Mm-hmm.
When you truly know history, honest history, you know the future. And that's the way it goes, you know. And again, that's the thing that we're seeing now in the media. You know, the same thing that happened to the Jewish people in Germany, where they started putting pictures of portraying Jewish people as rats in their newspapers, mm-hmm. and just calling them unclean. And basically the dehumanization of people who are different than yourself.
Yeah.
And that's the predecessor to some really ugly stuff. And they're starting to do that in cartoons and stuff in newspapers with, you know, portraying people who maybe, you know, who are not getting the virus as unclean. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, so look, if people think that genocide can't happen again, I don't know what to tell them. I don't know what to tell them, because mankind is so programmable to dislike each other. You know, I mean, you can see it clearly, and we saw it coming a mile away with the media programming people to dislike people of other, because they have a different skin pigmentation.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the same thing that happened in the 80s with crack cocaine in some of the ghettos and impoverished parts of the country, where, right. you know, this drug kind of started wiping people out. This opiate epidemic, this isn't hitting, you know, like you know, it's hitting everybody, but it's hitting those impoverished places so much more intensely. And I'm like, there's a lot of these things that kind of keep reciprocating, right? It keeps on coming back. And it's like, the writing's on the wall. So at what point do we, for our own lives, our own sanctity, our own sobriety, what have you, just kind of stand up and be like, whoa, time out for a sec. Let's reevaluate and see, you know, where we're going wrong. So I think it's interesting how you described, you know, having your spinal cord issue and going right. numb on that side, but then using the other side to get the job done, so to speak. It's like, I would have thrown in the towel, man. I've been like, all right, I got to go. You know, that mindset of like, you know, I don't have this, but now I have this. I think it's an interesting way to adapt to the world. And it seems like that's kind of what you've been doing is, you know, you're not down and out until you're on the ground out. I think that's kind of an interesting thing. Is that something you've always had, or was that a learned behavior?
Oh, I think through just different, being under pressure a lot,
mm-hmm.
You know, I think that, you know, when you get used to the pressure of, I don't know, climbing in a cage against another man who's trained to potentially put you in the hospital,
mm-hmm.
You know, so you, you, I guess, get used to being cooked, so to speak.
Right.
And it kind of prepares you. But I can tell you this, that for me, fighting was very easy. I never had any emotion when I fought. There was like one guy that I didn't like that I fought, and I mm-hmm. kind of put a little extra on him. Yeah. But for the most part, it was just, it was work. It was stoic, very little emotion, and just go to work and analyze, you know, the problem in front of me. But where ultra running is different than that, it is now your opponent is yourself.
Yourself, yeah.
And that's a tough one, man. That's a tough one, because my brain was lying to me all the time on long training runs and stuff, you know,
yeah.
just some crazy stuff that, you know, and the people that I'm running with, I'm looking at them, and these are, you know, a banker, a professor at the local college, a John Deere executive. They don't show any emotion when they're running. None, none. They're just having fun, laughing, doing whatever. And I'd always look at them and go, man, these guys are nuts.
Solid, yeah.
Nuts.
Mm-hmm. That's how David was to me. That David could take the most like obscure situation in some race, but turning into this like spiritual awakening. And I'm like, how, when he broke his Achilles tendon, I mean, that was, he was preparing to get into the cage.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was working with us at a treatment center that we had owned at the time. And he's helping with Addict Athlete. And I remember when he sent me the picture, I'm like, dude, what the heck? And he's like, well, this will be an interesting journey. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like your career, right. What is this? He's like, he was always that guy of like, well, how do I know this is a bad thing? You know? Yeah. And I'm like, well, because you have no Achilles tendon in that leg and you don't have money to pay for it. And he's like, yeah, but you know, how do you know it's bad? And then all of a sudden he's got this mindset of how it's going to be a good thing. And then it's rolling. I'm like, David, you've been able to raise this money for your, you know, for your Achilles tendon surgery. This is so awesome. And he's like, well, how do you know this is awesome? And I'm like, well, dude, because your leg was, you know, not usable. And now you've got the ability to fix it. And that mindset, I just think that's the most amazing thing. But you guys who can get into the cage or to, you know, can, you know, look at life and take it, you know, take it like on the chin, so to speak. I wish we could bottle that up and sell that to the people that I work with who don't quite believe that it's possible. They're afraid of taking the hit of sobriety. They're afraid of feeling life on life's terms. And I'm curious, like, what do you say to the people that you start training that are like, they want it, but when they're in the ring, you can tell that they're like, what am I doing here? Like, what do you tell those folks that you train with or that you prep for this? I mean, there's got to be some kind of fire inside, but when you're in that cage, like you said, it gets real, real quick.
Well, I mean, look, I mean, the thing was, is that by the time I let a guy get in the cage, mm-hmm. he had been prepared. He had been prepared. And that's the thing that, you know, a lot of fighters would come to me from around the country and around the world. And just to come train with us for, you know, a week, 6 weeks, depending, you know, a camp, a full fight camp to get ready. And if they weren't truly prepared or a very solid mindset already, 2 to 3 days into it, they just pack their bags and leave.
You'd see it fast then. You'd be like,
because I always had the room at about 95 degrees and, you know, at the height of my camp before I retired from coaching, you know, we had between 40 and 50 people in the room at the same time who were all ranked in the top 10 in the world in their weight divisions.
Mm.
And so every person that you grabbed for a 5 minute go in grappling or sparring or whatever we were doing, you were dealing with a pretty scary human being.
Right.
And so a lot of fighters would come, and they weren't used to, they might've been the big fish in a small pond where they came from. Right. They might've been one of the better guys. And so they'd never been pushed for 2 hours by numerous individuals who were world-class fighters, and they would just crumple. They didn't have the endurance. They didn't have the mindset. Their game wasn't tight enough, whatever. And they just, there were several times where people would just go over and they'd say, I'm done. And pick up their bag, their equipment bag. And everybody in the room, all the fighters from my camp would look at them and go, you walk out that door, you're not coming back, man.
Yeah.
And they'd kind of contemplate, they'd stare at us. And most of the time they walked out the door anyway, but a few of them, the guys that dropped the bag and walked back on the mats were the guys that got really good.
I love that. I love that because that's the same thing to a certain degree that happens when I'm doing like a therapy session with a group of people that are just right at the verge of making change, and you start pushing those buttons and they see, you know, that maybe that core issue, and the ones that get up and walk, the same thing happens. The group members are like, if you walk out that door, you know, you're going out to use and you're not coming back. Yet the ones that grab the doorknob, they're contemplating turning it, but turn around and go sit back down and say, all right, a minute, they become the ones that get the most out of it. I think that's an interesting thing in our human mind, what we think we can and can't handle. I that blows my mind. It's cool that you see that in the same realm that I've seen it on an emotional level. That's the coolest thing ever.
Yeah. And that's the thing that I'm trying to get a grasp on still. I mean, I recently learned and had an epiphany. A good friend of mine, who's a hypnosis expert and a motivational speaker. I see him as, he's much younger than I am, but he's supremely intelligent and self-aware. Very, he's like another David Clark.
Brilliant.
And you know, he and I talked quite a bit. We've talked quite a bit, and he's going to start doing hypnosis on me. But he sent me a video that, even if this video is not true, and it would be too mind-blowing, this video is too mind-blowing for the average person, and I'm not saying that I'm not average intellectually. I'm just saying that I think the pressures that I've dealt with in life and some of the tragedies and things like that have opened something up, a portal in my mind or my soul, that at the time I watched the video, I was absolutely ready for the information to come to me.
Nice.
And I messaged him back and I said, after watching that video, I no longer have any anger. I don't even hate the people that are doing the things they're doing to mankind, that are waging war for greed and all the other stuff. I don't hate them because now I understand why they're doing what they're doing. And now I finally understand why I made the missteps that I have in life. I finally understand it. And it was like a rush, like a kind of like a wave of love that just blasted through me.
Wow. You know,
and I didn't need to eat ayahuasca to get it done.
Yeah. Yeah. You didn't need that chemical boost to see into it. That's an amazing epiphany of self-awareness, but that's part of what I'm thinking with you is you mentioned this and I'm so curious, like when you're in the cage and you're fighting with someone, with the exception of the one that you talked about, how do you not walk away from them enemies? I mean, you think fight equals enemy, winner, loser. How is that not the case? How is it a brotherhood, a fellowship? How do you not see it that way?
I think it is, you know, the bond that is formed between, you know, military personnel, no matter who they are, that have had to be in combat, who have seen their friends die, seen their friends get hurt. They have such a bond with each other because they've experienced the most extreme fight that any human could ever be in. Agreed. I mean, the things that, you know, I'm lucky enough to have worked with some very high level military individuals who've come, you know, in big groups and stuff and trained with me when I had my camp. And, you know, some of the horrors that those guys have seen is unimaginable.
Yeah.
So when you step way down to the next level of intensity, it would be just a hand-to-hand combat, right?
Right.
It's nothing like war. We can't say, you know, I hate it when people go, this fight is an absolute war. No, it's not. It's not a war. It's a fight.
Good point.
Okay. It's a fist fight. But you gain respect for the people that you compete against because you know what you've been through emotionally to have to be able to get in there, right?
Yeah.
You know, and it also dawned on me that, you know, why I'm helping people with black oxygen so much, I finally found something that I could help mankind with because I had ruined a lot of men's dreams in achieving mine.
Good point.
And that's where I fell in love with ultra running because everybody wants you to succeed that's competing against you.
Yeah.
And it's just there's a lot of love in that sport, right? There's a lot of love. But there's a bond because, look, ultra running, I never thought I'd even run a marathon. And, you know, and there I was in the middle of my training doing a marathon on a Saturday and then another marathon distance on Sunday.
Yeah.
And thinking, holy cow, this is
what is this?
Nuts, mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, so yeah, it's just, you just learn to, yeah, it's a bond, right? It's
yeah.
Definitely a bond.
God,
torture can only, you know, I don't see any stronger bond than going through hell with other people.
Duh. You know, spot on. Yeah.
And I apologize, but I got to start my car.
Yeah, you're fine.
My battery's going dead, and I'm going to charge my phone while we're talking.
You are just fine. And while you're doing that, I'll agree with you. It's the same thing with people in recovery. It's the same thing I've noticed on Team Addict to Athlete. It's these people that are no longer, you know, like trying to, like, you know, single themselves out with their drug of choice. Now they're healing together and they're experiencing things together as a team. And it's been the most amazing thing to watch these, you know, brothers and sisters literally in arms on this recovery path. Cause I think there's nothing more amazing than watching them accomplish something they never thought possible. So, and I love your analogy like that. Yeah. It's like, you know, it's a ultra running. It's a thing of love. It's the weirdest thing. I love trail running 10 times more than road running, because the road runners are, you know, they're the guys that are fancy shoes around there, come back after they finish to, you know, to cheer you on, and they're wearing their medals, and it seems a little bit more cocky out there on the trail. It's like people are, they, man, they want you to succeed. They're like giving you all kinds of kudos, and you're looking like death warmed over and like, you got this. And you're like, I don't know if you see, I don't got this, but it's an amazing experience. And that's what I've noticed about people in recovery and ultra running athletics, is that all of a sudden the playing field is equal again. And I've noticed people with addictions, they are the most amazing athletes, because the same principles apply. It's yeah. the fighting for what you want. It's the not giving up when you really want something. It's the creating something out of nothing. It's one of the most amazing things. And just reading about your career path, it blew me away at how much you've been a part of and how influential you've been on so many people. I'm curious if any of that stands out to you, like these situations, these experiences you've had. Has there been any like real pinnacles of like, you know, self-learning, but also like, I've achieved this. This is incredible. I can't believe that on the other side of this, I'm still standing. Is there anything like that that stuck out to you in your career?
You know, it's weird when you're, you know, I started fighting, number one, because I guess, you know, I still had a lot of, competitive mindset anyway, mm-hmm. Right. It was by chance that I thought was by chance, but I think it was God leading me to it, mm-hmm. Where my foreman, on the concrete company that I was working for was a black belt in karate, and he was from Kentucky. And he started talking about a karate man being able to beat up a wrestler. And I'm going off on a tangent a little bit, but I'll explain it to you. But,
I love it.
He said, yeah, in his southern accent, karate man be able to beat up a wrestler any day. And I go, apparently you haven't wrestled with anybody from Iowa. And so anyway, he goes, well, we go out in the field lunchtime. We can find out. And I go, all right, let's do it. So I just took him down. I didn't hurt him. I slapped him around a little bit. Uh-huh. And he goes, I had no idea. He goes, you need to come to, the gym that I train at and learn to do kickboxing and karate. So I said, yeah, I'll do it. So that started me down the road of doing that. But ultimately what I sat in my basement, my mom's basement. I woke up in the morning, I put my feet down in about 4 inches of water, because that basement flooded every time it rained.
Oh, man. And
that's why my respiratory system was damaged from black mold.
Yeah.
My entire childhood. Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, I realized that I was in a place in my life that I didn't want to stay. I didn't want to stay in that place. And I wanted to see my brothers had committed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother was just, it destroyed her. It
really right. Did.
And so I just decided that morning, you know, because I'd already started fighting, that I was going to win a world title. I was going to be a UFC champion. And that I was going to make her smile again,
you know? Uh-huh.
And that you know, a guy was going to write he wrote a script and had the movie sold to Lionsgate, but my agent at the time said the life rights money that they're giving you is so low that you really shouldn't give out your story. You shouldn't okay it. But the name of the movie was Make Mom Smile.
Brilliant.
Yeah. So
brilliant.
It was. You know, a very, and my mother, you know, that's the thing is, you know, my entire family dealt with alcoholism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she was sober for about 30 years, I think, when she died.
Wow.
But there was one day, you know, when I didn't have any alcoholic symptoms or anything. I wasn't going down that path. Mm-hmm. I was a pretty driven, pretty happy guy at the time. But I was watching my mom fall apart, and I went in, and I was pretty young at the time. And, I went in her bedroom, and I basically looked everywhere in her room and made a huge pile of vodka bottles in the center of her bedroom.
Wow.
And then I went out to the living room, and I said, "Hey mom, can you come to your room for a second? I want to show you something." Mm-hmm. And so she got in there, and she was just stunned. She was stunned at what she was looking at. I said, "Listen," I go, "you've met all your grandsons and granddaughters from my siblings." I said, "But I don't have kids yet. I want them, you know, to meet their grandmother."
I want them to meet you. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, we took her, she quit cold turkey and she went into severe DTs.
Right.
We took her to the emergency room and her heart stopped.
Oh my gosh.
And they resuscitated her. They shocked her and brought her back a couple different times. And then, so she ended up having stents put in her arteries. And then she went to 30-day inpatient.
Oh my gosh.
And from there, she stayed sober and ended up retiring from nursing. She was a nursing director at a hospital across the river, and then became the nurse and the counselor at a center for alcohol and drug services.
Brilliant.
Here in Iowa. So, you know, little did I know at the time that I would end up battling alcoholism.
Yeah. Yeah. You wouldn't think so, would you? Cause you're like, I watched it kind of tear my family apart, but I can only imagine. Here's you kind of showing mom like, "Hey, I love you. I want you to be able to see now my family," and then have your mom go through that. And you thinking, "Shoot, did I maybe step on some toes too early?" But to have it come out the way that it was, again, that's that ability to see past some of that fear, man. Like, I know on the other side of this, it's going to be better, but we have to go through a little bit of hell to get there. Pat, that's amazing, man. And what an incredible mother to be able to feel that and not be mad at you or to be like, how dare you, but to like take it in stride and to be like, "Oh my gosh, he's right." I don't think kids listen to their parents listen to their kids as much as we should, but that's an amazing ability for you to say, "I care about you enough to like show you that this is hurting a lot of us." Man, that's
And you know what's interesting is she stuck around long enough to meet all three of my daughters. And it wasn't long after my youngest daughter was born that she passed away.
Man, see, anyone that says that you're full of it and you can't see past all that stuff is a fool themselves, because you're right. That's not a coincidence, Pat. You know that. That's not a coincidence. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Brother, our time goes by so fast. I'm curious, how do people get in touch with you? What social medias do you follow? You've mentioned your podcast. I want to give you a little bit of time here to have us tune into what you're doing, because I think you've got some great stuff that you're a part of. How do they find you?
Yeah, they can follow me at PJ Miletich on Instagram at PJ Miletich, and then they can hear my podcast at theconspiracyfarm.com.
Awesome.
And then they can find Black Oxygen, which I can't say treats, cures, or prevents anything, but all I can tell you is it adds 45% more oxygen at a cellular level, which my ultra running buddies who are in their 50s have dropped a minute to 2 minutes off their per mile time, and 30, like some of their heart rates are 30 beats less per minute. And you don't do that in your 50s.
No.
And so this stuff has changed a lot of lives. And let's just put it this way, that the oncologists at the University of Iowa, after they saw what it did for my brother was done. My brother was done.
Yeah.
He was 100, he's 6'4", 6'5", 160 pounds at the time, and as yellow as a school bus. I figured maybe he was going to be around for a month. And I got him started on Black Oxygen. And in 2 months, he was in remission. And the oncologist, and he had blastoid mantle cell lymphoma, which is a very aggressive form of lymphoma.
Yeah.
So the oncologist at the University of Iowa started referring cancer patients to him to find out about Black Oxygen and get started on it. That's a powerful thing. And I've seen the same thing with people with rheumatoid arthritis, diabetes, COPD, asthma, And then the athletes are just, they're crushing their PRs. So it's, they can go to blackoxygenorganics.com /PJ Milicic.
Awesome, man. Well, you're living proof that if you're using that and you're still up and swinging, I'm telling you, brother, like I'm a believer in it then too, because yeah, you're right. There's so many reasons why you should be in a wheelchair in some retirement home, but you're like, nah, life on life terms. I'm taking it by the horns. I love it, brother. I love it. Pat, thank you so much for being a part of Addict Athletes Podcast. Listeners, you've been well fed. Check out some of Pat's material. He's got a lot of stuff on social media, specifically YouTube. I went and did a deep dive on him yesterday. There's some neat stories there. Go check him out. I want to thank Radio Ronin for the platform that you allow Addict Athlete to be a part of, the Radio Ronin family. And athletes, until next time, go turn that mess into a message.